This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, this is Jeremiah Jacques, contributing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. I'm filling in today for your regular host, Mr. Joel Hilliker. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour today. We have some really significant and interesting news stories to cover today, and our panel of trumpet writers are anxious to tell you all about them. Here in the studio in Edmond, Oklahoma, we have Andrew Miller.
Good to be here.
And Anthony Chibadidwe.
Good to be here.
And Philip Nice.
Hello.
And via Skype from our office in Jerusalem, Israel, we have Brent Noctegal.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Well, there's hardly a week that goes by that the Trumpet Hour doesn't discuss some aspect of the ongoing global order threatening activity of the Islamic Republic of Iran. And then not quite as often, but still pretty frequently, we talk about the ongoing global order threatening activity of North Korea. These two countries are geographically far apart, but ideologically, at least in their desire to push against the global order, they often seem pretty close together. And this week, some reports were published showing that these two rogue nations are actually quite a bit closer than most onlookers would have imagined. For this, we'll go to our man in the Middle East, Brent Noctegal.
Yeah, so it's quite interesting. Earlier this week, we had a piece on thetrumpet.com. It's not featured in the Trumpet Weekly, but you can go and read it at thetrumpet.com. It's entitled Iran and North Korea Seek Stronger Ties. It was written by Callum Wood, and it just details the fact that earlier this month, there was a really important meeting in Tehran, in Iran, where there were delegates from around the world that were meeting to discuss the Palestinian uprising or intifada against the Jews. And one very interesting character that was there was the chairman of the North Korea's Supreme People's Assembly, Cho Tae-bok. And Callum writes, what was the North Korean, one of the North Korean leaders doing there in Iran, really taking part on in a conference that's about Palestine? There's something more to this relationship, he says, that warranted just a friendly meeting between North Korea and the Iranians. Then 2 days later, what we had was a paper that was released by some Israelis, former generals and nuclear experts, and they write in this paper that Iran is progressing towards nuclear weapons via North Korea. And it's a five-page document, and it goes step by step showing that since the early 90s, Iran and North Korea have been working together on their each individual nuclear program, sharing intelligence, sharing ballistic missile technology, and even sharing technologies related to the development of nuclear weapons themselves, the nuclear part of it, not just the weapon system to get them there.
And this is something that Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Fleury has called attention to probably before this was much more than just rumors. Is that right?
Right. Well, there has been a number of stories on this going back, I would say, to the early 2000s. This was reported. What are North Koreans doing in Iran? What are their scientists doing in Iran? Mm-hmm. The nuclear tests that between 2013 and 2016, North Korea's had a number of nuclear tests. You've got Iranians there, scientists watching these nuclear tests in North Korea. What are they doing? And yes, Gerald Fleury has brought attention to this in his book, The King of the South. But I thought what was interesting about this report was just the timing of when the nuclear arrangement or the collusion between the two countries increased. And as they document and as we've put in our article here, it really increased in the months surrounding the very beginning of the nuclear deal, when Iran was approached by President Obama. He wrote a couple of letters to the Iranians back in 2012 saying, we're ready to reach a deal with you with your nuclear program if you are willing to make some sacrifices. Well, he wrote that in 2012, just I think that was in July. 2 months later, we have this formal agreement between North Korea and Iran to partner on a whole host of issues. And the contention of these two scientists that wrote this paper is that that was when they decided to go fully on board with the North Koreans in really outsourcing their the Iranian nuclear program to North Korea. And North Korea would receive funding from Iran. In an ultimate twist of fate, Iran receives $150 billion around that of unfrozen assets at the time of the nuclear deal was implemented. And they say a lot of that money, where did that go? That probably went to North Korea to continue Iran's nuclear development program, but just off-site.
Wow. So it really looks like there were indications that the Obama administration would have been able to see that Iran had not actually discontinued its nuclear work. It had just sort of transferred it so that it was outsourcing it, in a sense, to North Korea.
Well, it does. It does seem that way. I mean, it's hard to be sure how much they knew, but back in April of 2016, there was a clash between the Deputy Secretary of State Antony Blinken and Republican Brad Sherman during a U.S. House Foreign Affairs Committee hearing, and what the Democrat was upset about with the Deputy Secretary of State was that there were a number of planes that were flying in and out of Iran to North Korea and back again during the time that the nuclear deal was being implemented, just 2 months before they actually in June in 2015, 2 months before they actually signed the deal. There was a lot of travel between North Korea and Iran, and they were upset. At least this congressman was upset by the fact that the United States had failed to rigorously inspect those cargo planes. Because what were they carrying?
Right.
And he said, well, that was an opportunity to look into it. But then Mr. Sherman said, and he charged at that time, that it hadn't been handled very well or with sufficient care by the Obama administration, because Iran might have been getting rid or moving some of its nuclear infrastructure to North Korea.
Wow. Well, that really is a sobering development. We appreciate you bringing us up to speed on that, Brent. Well, North Korea and Iran may be the most, you know, transparent and virulent of the countries that are pushing against the established global order, but they certainly are not the only ones. Over the last several years, we've also seen the Russian Federation become increasingly determined to restore its former glory and to expand its power and to just basically have its way in its periphery and beyond. And this week, there were a couple of reports published showing that in some really vital areas, Russia is gaining ground, even in a literal way. For this, we'll go to Anthony Chibadidwe.
Just some background information to begin with. In 2014, Vladimir Putin's Russia invaded Ukraine. And the biggest and most apparent outcome from that invasion and the chaos that ensued was Russia's annexation of the Crimean Peninsula in southeastern Ukraine. And this was a very bold, very blatant act by Russia and by President Putin. And it's part of Putin's goal to restore the Soviet Empire. Well, this week we learned that Putin is pulling another Crimea in two separatist regions in eastern Ukraine, very close to the border with Russia. But this time around, Putin is doing so in a manner that's a little more subtle, but very decisive nonetheless. Mm. Last week, President Putin signed an executive order that authorized the recognition of passports, birth certificates, death certificates, diplomas, vehicle registrations, and other documents from Luhansk and Donetsk. This amounted to a de facto recognition of the self-proclaimed Luhansk People's Republic and the Donetsk People's Republic. And again, it's a little different from Crimea, but essentially, it's the exact same thing. Now, on Monday, officials from Luhansk announced that the Russian ruble would be the official currency of their breakaway territory beginning Wednesday, March 1st. So here you have a territory in Ukraine that's essentially ditching the Ukrainian currency and embracing the Russian currency.
Yeah, I imagine the government in Kiev there, Ukraine, probably wasn't happy about that move.
That's tantamount to a hostile takeover right there. And this is just the latest of President Putin's taking over parts of Ukraine incrementally and piece by piece, making steady progress of just grabbing all those territories. And of course, the people, the leaders in Ukraine, they said that this was a violation of the Minsk agreements. And these agreements, they decided that they're going to work to de-escalate the situation in Ukraine. And of course, Russia was party to that. But right now, Russia is actually adding fuel to the fire. And so the leaders in Ukraine are condemning Russia for violating those agreements. But again, Russia is pouring fire into this crisis. They are putting fire into this crisis, but in a very subtle way, and in a very decisive way as well. So it's likely going to proceed as it always has been.
Yeah. Do you expect Russia to soon make Luhansk and Donetsk official parts of Russia's territory like it did with Crimea? Or do you think it would be more likely for Russia to make them just sort of de facto autonomous pro-Russia regions like the case with those two regions in Georgia?
It's you can see go both ways. But really, I think that the most important thing to take from here is that it doesn't even need to just pull another Crimea, because essentially these regions are already in Russia's orbit. It seems like that's about all that Russia needs. It could even go for more if it wants, but what already has happened is just powerfully significant. Here at the Trump, we've been watching Vladimir Putin for the 18 years he's been in power. We've been writing a lot about it. And if our readers look at thetrumpet.com, you will find that President Putin is on 5 covers of our magazines. Mm. That's more than any other politician.
Wow.
So we've been keeping an eye on him. And in 2008, after Russia invaded Georgia, our editor-in-chief, Gerald Fleury, he said this. He said that Russia's attack on Georgia in August marks the beginning of a dangerous new era in history. This was the first military strike of a rising Asian superpower, and there will be more. It is critical you understand the meaning behind this attack, and a lot has happened since that, and it is important that people understand what's going on there. You could essentially say Russia has since grabbed South Ossetia from Georgia and Abkhazia and Crimea from Ukraine, and now Luhansk and Donetsk. And Bible prophecy indicates that Russia is not done quite yet.
So time has really vindicated that 2008 assessment there by Mr. Fleury.
Indeed.
Well, thanks very much for that, Anthony. You're listening to The Trumpet Hour, our Week in Review program on 101.3 KPCG. And most of the stories that we'll be discussing today come from our publication called The Trumpet Weekly. That is a free weekly newsletter that brings you all the most significant news stories from each week, along with some hard-hitting analysis. To subscribe to it, you just need to go to thetrumpet.com, click on the Subscriptions tab, there and you'll see it. Our cover story on this week's edition is an article about the Democratic Party here in the United States. The Democrats have recently suffered some pretty serious losses, not just in the recent presidential election, but also in the Senate, House, and elsewhere. And now, in response to those losses, they are kind of recalibrating, regrouping, and making a big shift. And it's a move that could lead to some really serious problems for America. This Trumpet Weekly article was actually written by Andrew Miller, who's here with us, and we'll get him to chime in on the discussion a bit too. But to explain what's really going on here, we'll first go to Philip Nice.
Well, thank you, Jeremiah. In the past 8 years, 2008 to 2016, of course, the Obama administration has been in power, and that's been sort of a golden age for American progressivism. You've had the Obama, Reid, Pelosi presidency congressional complex with Congress sort of functioning as a rubber stamp for the president. Yep. Congress, basically the balance of power there being controlled by the Democrats. But one thing that's easy to miss is that the Democratic Party actually atrophied quite a bit during and especially after the Obama presidency. And I've read more than once that Democrats were actually pretty frustrated with the president because he did not go out of his way to help the party long term.
Okay.
So as you sort of indicated there, since he was elected in 2008, Democrats have lost 9 seats in the Senate. And there's only 100 seats in the Senate, 62 yeah. seats in the House of Representatives. And then in 2016, they lost the presidency. They lost the House. They lost the Senate. They lost the ability to appoint Supreme Court justices, definitely one, perhaps two or three. They also lost 12 more governorships. And at this point, there are only 6 states in the union that have a Democratic governor and a Democratic majority in the legislature. So
wow.
The party now controls fewer elected seats, all told, than at any time since 1926.
That is staggering.
So wow. you have to go back pretty far. So for people who've been really chafing under the hard left liberal administration of President Obama, it's easy to lose track of the fact that really the Democratic Party is kind of in turmoil. All the headlines were about the Republican Party being in turmoil and about to split. Then there was the surprise election mm-hmm. in 2016 that brought President Trump to power. But the Democratic Party is now kind of in that same situation. So on Saturday, the Democratic National Committee held its elections for a new chairman. The previous two, or the previous chairwoman and her temporary replacement, were both marked by scandals, so even the Democratic National Committee is kind of struggling right now and looking to retool. So they had an election, and it was down between two men, and the first one was Tom Perez, not a well-known name, but he was the labor secretary under President Obama, and in a very liberal administration, Perez was considered the most liberal of the liberals. In that administration, he was he led the charge against voter ID laws. He helped he led an organization to help illegal immigrants bypass U.S. immigration law before he became labor secretary. Assistant to the attorney general, Eric Holder, he led a lawsuit to try to block Florida. Florida was trying to purge 182,000 non-citizens from its voter rolls. It said, you know, you're not a citizen, you don't have the right to vote, so you shouldn't be voting. And he tried to block that. He also filed affirmative action lawsuits, tried to force municipalities to do away with written tests for police and firefighters because that was unfair to racial minorities. So he tried to push for even if they flunk their entrance exams, they can still get in based on their race.
Wow.
So you can sort of get his worldview from some of those things. But again, he was the most progressive socialist in a radically progressive socialist administration. So he was the option one. And he actually won the election. It was fairly close, 235 to 200 there in the DNC. And people booed. And people were in a little bit of an outrage because they supported the other candidate. And the reason they were booing Tom Perez is because he was not hard left enough compared to the other candidate. And the other candidate, probably even more well-known right now, Keith Ellison. And this is the first Muslim elected to Congress. He's from Minnesota. In his past, he's gone by Keith Hakim, Keith X Ellison after Malcolm X,
wow.
and Keith Muhammad. He said his political awakening was by reading the autobiography of Malcolm X. He has been associated with Louis Farrakhan's Nation of Islam. He supports single-payer health care, Black Lives Matter. And so he's even harder left. And so he did lose the election, but Tom Perez actually immediately motioned for him to be the co-chair of the Democratic National Committee. And this means that both of them will be at the leadership of the committee. And what Ellison is in charge of is something he's very, very good at, and that is organizing people on the local level. So he's going to be in charge of that, and he says we don't need a 50-state strategy. We need a 3,143-county strategy, and he's been very effective at that. So so as Andrew's article indicates, the Democratic Party shifts harder to the left. This is a time for choosing for the Democratic Party. Do we go back toward the center to try to regain some of the voters we've lost there, or do we go even harder left? And it seems like they've made a very, very clear choice.
Wow. Well, Andrew, do you see this as a strategy that's likely to work? Will the Democrats becoming, you know, more radical on the left mean that they'll be able to win back some of that lost ground for the party? And if so, what do you think that means for the U.S. as a whole?
Right. Well, it is definitely a sea change strategy for them. Pretty much since 1980, the Republicans and the Democrats have been in like this tug of war over a very particular moderate group of Democrats that have gone by many names, first called Reagan Democrats. These were Democrats, moderate Democrats, who left the Carter administration, voted for Ronald Reagan. Then the Clinton administration won that group of people back, and then the Bush administration got a few of them back, and then Obama administration pulled them back again. Mm-hmm. And now they've actually gone for Donald Trump. So they've keep going back and forth. But in the 30 years since then, there's been a new generation that's come to voting age, the millennials, who are even the farthest left generation of any in American history so far. Yeah. So that is the Democratic strategy, is they're like, we'll let the Trump Republicans keep the Reagan Democrats. We actually have a new group power base we can get to vote for us to try to gain power back. In the short term, I don't know if it's going to get them many seats back, because as they go further left, they will start bleeding more quote-unquote Reagan Democrats to the Republican administration.
Yeah.
But it is dangerous in the effect that if you're not actually – if your goal is to control the country and you can't control it through elected seats – your only option is like Keith Ellison said in the article we've got on our website right now, is to have like mass rallies across the countries to shut things down. And so I think in the months ahead, you'll see the Democrats becoming definitely much more. Some of these, like Keith Ellison, he's written a number of given a number of interviews and written articles for different communist organizations, including the Communist Party in the USA. Over his political career. So I think you'll see much more of a, like, quote unquote, like Marxist style political insurgency to try to put pressure from below, since they've lost the power to put pressure from above.
Wow.
Just a quick point there to your point about the millennials and it's that strategy. Ellison is a man who read Franz Fanon, a Marxist as a young man. And like you said, the millennials are the most hard left demographic we've had yet. Just one interesting statistic on that. During the last election, Bloomberg says that if only millennials had voted, the Democratic candidate would have won the election with 473 electoral votes to 32.
That is stunning. Wow, so it would have been a real landslide. And that's the generation that's now coming of age and will be filling more and more leadership positions in everything from politics to education. So it really does seem to portend a radical shift to the left for the nation as a whole. Well, thanks very much for that, Philip, and also Andrew. It really sounds like America's political landscape could be experiencing some major changes. And there's another story this week showing that Germany could also soon undergo some big political shifts. Germany's political campaign season started this week. And to tell us about what's going on there, we'll go back to Andrew.
Right. Well, it's a tradition in Germany that March 1st is Ash Wednesday for the Catholic Church. And then in Germany, it's become a tradition that's kind of like the unofficial start of their campaign season. So we're definitely seeing all the political parties giving out there and giving speeches for the German election coming up this September. And I think the biggest thing that surprised people this week is how American their campaign season started. Germans are normally known for being much more polite to their political opponents, at least since the 40s. They've been much more polite to their political opponents than the American campaigns. But here you're definitely seeing a little bit more of like that mudslinging spirit where you've got the new social Democrat politician, Martin Schulz, mm-hmm. who's really just going out there saying how that Germany needs to stand up to Trump because he's a chauvinist and a sexist who mocks the disabled. And he's really lambasted Angela Merkel and tried to sow seeds of division between her Christian Democratic Union and the Christian Social Union by saying that it's like, well, that political union's like a marriage that's where the partners aren't talking to each other anyway. Hopefully it will fall apart.
Wow.
And he's done a huge, huge spike in popularity for the Christian, for the Social Democratic Union. That's Germany's. There's four political parties in the German parliament, but the two main ones are the Christian Democratic Union is Germany's conservative party, center right. And then the Social Democratic Union is their center left. And just since Martin Schulz announced his candidacy a couple weeks ago, support for the Social Democratic Party has gone up roughly 10%. So he's neck and neck with Merkel for popularity. He's really drawn a lot of support away with this new leader from Merkel's coalition.
I wonder if you care to offer any speculation about how Chancellor Merkel will fare. I know she's managed to stay in power there for much longer than many of us would have imagined, but what do you think? Could this be the year that she is defeated?
That's definitely what the Social Democratic Party wants. The thing is that, and this is back in the 80s, Franz Josef Strauss used to have two rules that he always said that you needed to abide by in German elections. He said, one, he said, never form a grand coalition. That's where you have the main right-wing party and the main left-wing party form a coalition with each other. He said, because if you have a grand coalition, when people get mad at the government, they have to vote for fringe parties.
Oh, okay.
He said, and second, he said, because he was a Christian Democrat. He said, never let a party get to the right of the Christian Democrats. We don't want to let Germany go far right. So try to keep people in the center right area. And during Merkel's campaign, she did not heed this advice and she formed this grand coalition. And so what we've seen that is just like Strauss had predicted, people got upset with the Merkel administration. They couldn't vote for her main rival because they were in the government with her. So the left party in Germany, which is like the German Communist Party, has ballooned out to about 15% public support. And this really nationalist alternative for Deutschland party has ballooned out to about 15% support. Wow. So now you have, it looks like this election, instead of being four parties in the Bundestag, there's going to be six.
Okay.
And the thing is, when you have that many political parties, none of them have enough support to actually become chancellor without a coalition. Yeah. And ironically, right now, the only coalition option that would give you enough support is another grand coalition, which is not something Germans want. So whether Merkel becomes chancellor again or not, it's really too early to tell. But her government is going to be much, much, much weaker than it's been in the past because she's not going to have people who are devoted to her way of doing things in her coalition. It's going to be a very shaky coalition that they have to patch together unless something big changes in the next few months before the election on September 24th, I believe it is.
Well, it's definitely something we'll be keeping a close eye on and bringing you updates about in the lead up to that election. Thanks very much for bringing us up to speed on that there, Andrew. You're listening to Trumpet Hour here on KPCG 101.3 on the FM dial, and the live stream is available anywhere in the world if you just type kpcg.fm into your internet browser. Coming up, we're going to talk about China expanding its overseas presence, elements in the Catholic Church attempting to ban work on Sunday, whether America's generals can save the country, and we'll also talk about a dam project in Ethiopia that could have global geopolitical effects. We'll be back in a moment. We'll be right back.
listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
This is Jeremiah Jacques filling in for your regular host, Mr. Joel Hilliker. Well, in the first half, we talked about Russia making progress in expanding its power and influence beyond its borders. And there's clear evidence that Russia's increasingly close partner, China, is doing the same thing far beyond its borders, all the way in Africa. Anthony Chibadidwe has written an article about this in the Trumpet Weekly called Chinese Naval Base in Djibouti Nears Completion. What can you tell us about this development, Anthony?
Well, this is a very, very big development. It's a geopolitical earthquake because this is China's first military base abroad, first ever. And what's significant about that is that not many nations have military bases abroad. Mm-hmm. It's only a handful of nations. It's only the big powers of this world. And now China is announcing that it is one of those big powers that's assertive and militarily advanced, that has global ambitions, that require a strong military to back them. 2 years ago, China announced that it would be building a naval base in the East African nation of Djibouti. They broke ground early last year, and the base will begin operations later this year. China has been downplaying the operational scope of the base and saying that it's just a mere support facility for its Navy's anti-piracy, humanitarian, and peacekeeping operations in the Horn of African region. There's a lot of trade that takes place in that area, and a lot of pirates as well. And China has just been saying that this is just a support facility for some of its humanitarian and peacekeeping and anti-piracy activities there. But China hasn't even disclosed how many people will be, how many officers will be stationed at that naval base. So there's a lot of information that China has been withholding. But guess what? The foreign minister of Djibouti told the Financial Times that the number of the Chinese personnel will probably be a few thousand.
Wow.
A few thousand soldiers at this naval base, its first ever naval base. And the information that we have about that is that it'll provide maintenance facilities for ships and helicopters, docks for commercial ships and military vessels, and storage facilities for weapons. The New York Times had a story about this, and it quoted from Professor Peter Dutton of the Naval War College. He has studied satellite images of the base, and he said that this is a huge strategic development. He said that China has learned lessons from Britain of 200 years ago, and this is what expansionary powers do. Now, some more significant details about this base is that China chose to build its first ever foreign base near the strategic Bab el Mandeb choke point that leads into the Red Sea and the Suez Canal. It's the fourth busiest maritime choke point in the world. 3.8 million barrels of oil pass through it every day, and some of it goes straight to China. So China has a lot of economic interests there to protect.
Yeah.
But another significant piece of detail about this is that China is building its first ever foreign base near Camp Limonier. And Camp Limonier is America's only full-scale military base in Africa. So here you're seeing China announcing to the world, we're building our first ever military base, and it's going to be very close to America's only base in Africa. And this American base has been established since the war on terror began in 2001, and America has been using it to collect intelligence on Islamic terrorist networks in that region. And China is setting up shop just close by, and it's going to undercut American operations. There's going to be a tremendous risk in military espionage. So this is just another trend that we have been watching, a weakened America and a rising China.
Well, thanks very much for bringing that to us, Anthony. For this next story, we're going to hop right across the border from Djibouti to its neighbor, Ethiopia. I think it was embarrassingly late in life for me when I learned that the Nile River actually flows northward into the Mediterranean Sea instead of originating in the Mediterranean and flowing south. But that's how it works. Some of the waters from the mighty Nile actually originate all the way down in Ethiopia, then flow up into Sudan and then into Egypt. But the Ethiopians are now building a huge dam, which the Egyptians fear could give Ethiopia the power to shut down the Nile. And to tell us about this dam and this threat and what these tensions might lead to, we'll go once again to Brent.
Yeah, this is a story that we've been watching just as this grand Ethiopian Renaissance dam comes out of the ground. It's been building. It's being built for quite a number of years now, and it's about 70% complete. And as you were noting, I think it's very important that you did mention that at the beginning, that you didn't realize that the Nile traveled northward. But yes, it does. And 60% of the water that reaches the Nile inside Egypt actually comes from the Blue Nile upstream from Ethiopia that would pass right through this area where Ethiopia is building this dam. Now, for any other country in the world, it wouldn't necessarily be the biggest deal if somebody upstream had a dam on one of your rivers, but this is the Nile River. This is Egypt's main source of water. Nearly all of Egypt's 94 million residents live right along the Nile River because that's their source of fresh water. I mean, if you go back into ancient history, the Nile was a god. The Nile had its own gods. Mm-hmm. It was the life of Egypt comes with the flowing of water into the Nile River. And Ethiopia, by the construction of this huge dam, right as it's at its source, threatens really the future livelihood of Egyptians, a country that right now is experiencing some of the highest inflation and poverty rates that it's seen in a very long time.
Yeah. Well, we've talked on the Trumpet Hour before about the prophecies in the book of Daniel and elsewhere that just really indicate that Egypt and Ethiopia will actually be allied together soon under the banner of the King of the South. I wonder if you have any thoughts about how the construction of this dam, which looks like it would threaten Egyptian-Ethiopian relations, how could that actually make that relationship stronger, as Bible prophecy indicates?
Right. So it's a good question, because you would think that Egypt would get so upset about this that a relationship would break with Ethiopia. And, you know, what we are thinking about and what we could see, and how Bible prophecy indicates that Egypt and Ethiopia will come together, it might be that Egypt gets so concerned about this dam nearing completion that it acts in a way to destabilize Ethiopia, as we've seen Iran do in many other countries where they have a unstable government. If they're able to go in there with some proxy organizations and destabilize the government, then you might have some regime change inside Ethiopia. Now, we'll have a lot of people, well, if there are people in Ethiopia listening to this, they'll say that's absolutely crazy. Mm. Ethiopia is a strongly Christian nation. It's never going to fall into the hands of Iran. But Egypt's an extremely strong power. And back in 2012, when this dam became a big political talking point between Egypt and Ethiopia, we saw Egypt already trying to inundate Ethiopia with weapons and possibly stage some type of military uprising there. So that's what it looks like, how this dam will be used, maybe to fulfill Bible prophecy, to cause regime change from the Egyptians inside Ethiopia.
Wow. Well, thank you very much for bringing us up to speed on that, Brent. All of the stories that we're discussing today, or almost all of them anyway, are found in our publication, The Trumpet Weekly. If you don't subscribe to that, I encourage you to visit thetrumpet.com and sign up to receive it. It's free, and the subscription process is very quick. For this next story, we'll take a look at another trend that the Trumpet has been watching for many years, which is the push by the Catholic Church to outlaw working on Sundays. It looks like this week one faction of the church may have made some progress in that push. And to tell us about this, we'll go once again to Andrew Miller.
The Catholic Bishops' Conference and the European nation of Croatia announced an initiative this week to legally forbid working on Sunday. hasn't been adopted yet, and it, we'll see if they do adopt this particular initiative. This is something they commonly do on Ash Wednesday. They've instituted similar initiatives in 2000, 2004, 2012, and I guess now 2017. So it's roughly every 4 years they institute this initiative to legally ban working on Sunday. And you're looking through the text of this year's initiative, and it definitely makes some exceptions for those who are like healthcare workers or security mm-hmm. workers or other types of emergency services. But for the rest of the nation, not even just Catholics who are supposedly going to go to Mass that day, they're saying that even other people in Croatia, they're trying to make this like a government binding day of rest and a day to like spend time with family and friends.
Andrew, this might be a little bit of a tall order, but I wonder if you could maybe just give us a condensed version of the biblically prophetic aspect of this. Maybe just sort of in a nutshell what the scriptures say will happen in the Catholic Church's push to ban Sunday work.
Right. Well, because I mean, first of all, it's just when you're looking at an initiative like this, it's always concerning just to the fact that you've got, they're recommending that you have a government power with the authority to tell people when they will work and when they will not work.
Yeah.
And that's concerning in any context. But as the Trumpets reported for a long time, and then the Plain Truth under Herbert Armstrong before us, there is definitely a prophecy in Revelation that talks about that there's going to be a 10-nation combine rise up in the area of the old Roman Empire, ruled over by a great false church, mm-hmm. and it will have a mark. They call it the Mark of the Beast,
right.
pretty well known even in popular culture, that they'll put on the people part of this. And then if you don't accept the mark, you'll neither be able to buy nor sell. And we have in a booklet that explains this in great detail by Herbert W. Armstrong called Who and What is the Prophetic Beast, that we can send any of our listeners that write into letters@thetrumpet.com. This just really goes through just the history of they talk about this mark being the number 666. And if you look at in the Greek, that number represents the Roman Empire and the Holy Roman Empire after that. And that is the mark the Holy Roman Empire after, from Constantine onward, always put on, is that they had the Catholic Church enforce Sunday worship. You couldn't work on Sunday, and if you did work on Sunday, you weren't able to buy or sell. And that is something that the Bible says will come back in the end time, and something we've followed for many years, and have a lot of literature we can send people that explain every detail of that prophecy. And this is something that we're seeing now increasingly in the European Parliament and in bishops' conference across Europe, that they're trying to bring back.
Wow. Yeah. Well, in that context, it really makes this push by the church there in Croatia really sound significant. Thanks very much for that, Andrew. For this next story, we'll take a look once again at the United States, where President Trump has installed what looks to be a genuinely impressive group of outstanding generals in some key leadership positions. Some say that these military men could finally put America back on the path of winning wars. But we have an article in the Trumpet Weekly written by Abraham Blondeau that asks some tough questions about whether that will really be the case or not. And for this story, we'll go once again to Philip Nice.
Well, thank you, Jeremiah. That's right. General James Mattis is our Secretary of Defense. General John F. Kelly is Secretary of Homeland Security. And Lieutenant General H.R. McMaster is the National Security Advisor for the Trump administration. And President Trump has made some headlines for appointing these men, for putting so much stock in these leaders. But he's not the only one who has been impressed by their credentials. We have a quote here in this article, "In Generals We Trust" is the name of the article. And the quote is from historian Niall Ferguson. He says, "I do not say this lightly. Never in the history of the English-speaking peoples has there been an officer class this good? It is not just that they are smart and knowledgeable. Seared by the memory of Vietnam, they have an ethos of selfless public service that is unlike anything I have ever encountered. So it would be very hard for me to say which officer class in American history or in the history of the English-speaking peoples is the best. But it isn't so hard for Niall Ferguson to say that. He does have quite a bit of experience and authority. So anyway, they're good.
Yeah.
They're really good. And we have in this article, Abraham makes the point that he refers back to a point actually made by Herbert Armstrong in 1961. And he was the editor of The Plain Truth, of course. And he wrote this in 1961, unless or until the United States as a whole repents and returns to what has become a hollow slogan on its dollars, "In God We Trust," the United States of America has won its last war. So we have this quote from 1961 where Mr. Armstrong says the United States has won its last war. And now we have powerful, effective, high-quality generals who are not only the best, but they are in some of the highest positions in the administration. And they are leading the largest, the most advanced, the best military on the most powerful nation on earth. And in this article, Abraham says they won't win based on that prediction by Mr. Armstrong from 1961. So this article just really raises some interesting questions, as you said. Once you start to think back, wait a minute, have we won a war since 1961? Right. Mr. Armstrong actually says since World War II. So since 1945, we fought a lot of wars and we've had a lot of power. But, you know, if you really think about it, have we won them? That's a really interesting question. And the other thing that I kind of grapple with when I'm reading this is we have the tendency to divide cultural news from hard news. So like cultural society news from hard news like crime, jobs, politics, laws, economics, wars. This article makes the point that those two things are not just related. One is causing the other. Because like Mr. Armstrong said, it's repentance that helps you win wars. Those two things seem to be different when you think about, you know, going to church on Sunday and then you go out and you actually you know, make the decisions that actually affect the rest of your life as an individual and as a nation. But Mr. Armstrong says that these two things are related. So I just encourage people to have a look at that article in Generals We Trust and to ask themselves those hard questions.
Well, thanks very much for sharing your take on that situation there, Philip. I've recently been reading a book with a lot of material about Mr. McMaster, and he and the other generals there too really do strike me as just some unusually impressive individuals. But as you said, and as Abraham's article shows, it's just too little, too late. So it's a difficult reality to accept, I guess.
Yes.
This is the Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. Remember, you can find us online at thetrumpet.com. Cruise on in there to receive a free subscription to our weekly news report, The Trumpet Weekly. Almost all of these stories that we're talking about today are in this week's edition. We'll finish the program with our lightning round of important news from all of our panelists coming up next.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
It's time now for our lightning round. One last brief look at some of the other big headlines from this week that caught our attention. First, we'll go to Philip.
We'll see if this cultural news doesn't have something to do with the hard news we were talking about earlier. This is American society this week. On Sunday, millions of Americans watch the Academy Awards. That's where Hollywood awards itself for what it thinks are its best movies. And the best picture was a picture called Moonlight. It depicts the three stages of life for a black boy. And it is full of loneliness, shame, misery, and an aggressive homosexual agenda. In fact, there's even a pink triangle representing the homosexual agenda on the movie poster. And it's a pretty dark look at a miserable life for this young man, but it won Best Picture. This is your greatest movie, your most celebrated movie, your Best Picture of the year, America. And the same week, Disney released yet another Beauty and the Beast, and this one will feature a homosexual storyline. And in one of its cartoons for children, Disney also broadcasted what appears to be its first homosexual kiss. This is where American society is this week.
And now we'll go to Andrew.
More than 4,300 refugees from Iran, Iraq, Libya, Sudan, Somalia, Yemen, and Syria entered to the United States since last month when a Ninth Circuit judge struck down President Trump's travel ban. In retrospect, the travel ban was banning refugees from those seven nations for 120 days until the United States could figure out how to vet them more thoroughly. Then in an act of judicial activism, the Ninth Circuit struck that down as illegal. And now we've got over 4,000 refugees from those nations in the United States.
And Anthony.
The mystery over recent sightings of Chinese military vehicles patrolling inside Afghanistan deepened last week when China denied its troops were in Afghanistan, but confirmed that it was undertaking joint counterterrorism operations with Afghanistan. It seems like China is following Russia's footsteps of entering where America is leaving.
And then we will conclude with one more story from Brent.
The Telegraph reported this week that archaeologists have found a palace built in the 7th century BCE for the biblical Assyrian king Sennacherib and renovated by his son Esarhaddon. This palace was found underneath the Shrine of Jonah that's located inside the modern city of Mosul that the Islamic State overtook in 2014. And while the Islamic State destroyed much of that shrine because it was such an idol, as soon as they had blown bits of it up, they dug tunnels underneath it to try and find more artifacts to sell on the black market. In the past couple of weeks, archaeologists have gone into this area after the Islamic State was routed from eastern Mosul, and what they have discovered is this fantastic palace. Eleanor Robson, she's the head of the British Institute for the Study of Iraq, said that there's a huge amount of history down there, not just ornamental stones. It's an opportunity to finally map the treasure house of the world's first great empire from the period of its greatest success. So while Islamic State destroys artifacts, there is a silver lining here that we have discovered another palace of the Assyrians.
Thank you for that, Brent. I'm Jeremiah Jacques, filling in today for your regular host, Mr. Joel Hilliker, and we are coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. Look us up online at thetrumpet.com. We'll be happy to give you a free subscription to our weekly news report, The Trumpet Weekly. Just about all the stories that we've discussed today are in this week's edition. Tell us what you think of the program by emailing us at letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks very much to our panel, Andrew Miller, Anthony Chibadidwe, Philip Nice, and Brent Noctegal.
Good to be here.
Thanks for having me.
And thanks also to our technical staff, Dwight Falk and Abraham Blondeau. And I'll leave you today with some words by the British writer George Orwell. He said, "The further a society drifts from the truth, the more it will hate those that speak it." Well, thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. It's been a real pleasure. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.